Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about radio and ham radio and shortwave radio, and our guest today is James Wades. He's with the Morris Telegraph Club, WB8SIW. This is an interesting show. Even if you may not think you're interested in CW, you're going to want to listen to this. We'll be back with James Wades, WB8SIW, with the Morris Telegraph Club right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Our guest is James Wades. And I just want to say, is it James or do you go by Jim? Or
James or Jim, either one is fine.
Okay, now.
Yeah, Jim is fine if you'd like.
This fella is involved with something that I think is probably one of the most interesting things I have ever come across. And this is called the Morris Telegraph Club. And a friend of mine sent the brochure to me. They're a nonprofit association dedicated to perpetuating the knowledge of traditions and the traditions of telegraphy. I'll learn how to talk this morning sometime. I started going through this thing, and I thought, this has got to be the most fascinating thing in our day and time. You know, and I hear people say things. The weirdest things that I've heard so far is, you know, I hear people talk about, well, you know, since they dropped the code, it's going to destroy ham radio. You know, and I disagree with that. I don't think that's true at all. The other thing that I found very interesting is when we were at the Huntsville Ham Fest back some years ago, we're right next door to Vibroplex. And at that time, before Vibroplex sold, I talked to the owner, and he said, you know, it's a funny thing. He said, since they dropped the code restrictions, he said, we sell more stuff now than we did prior to. And then I talked to, I believe it was Gordon West. He said, our code CDs, you know, we're selling them at record numbers. And everyone I talked to had the same story, and I thought, isn't that interesting? You know, there is such an interest in Morse. There's such an interest in CW. There's something really, really fascinating about it on radio, but I need to get this fella to talking and tell a little bit about this organization they've got, and this is very unusual. So, James, I don't know where to tell you to start. I really don't. I guess you could talk about, I don't know, this KOB network, or possibly this MTC, where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with, of course, the origins of our organization. and its focus, and then of course we can go to move on to other areas. But the Morris Telegraph Club was founded in 1943, originally as a fraternal organization for retired railroad and commercial telegraphers. And it's evolved over the years into a historical association, and its purpose is to perpetuate the knowledge of the traditions and history of telegraphy and the telegraph industry. Now, it's important to understand at the outset, and it's something many people don't know throughout the world, and likewise many radio amateurs don't know, is that there are two different Morse codes. The original Morse code is developed by Morris and Vail, is called the American Morse Code. And the American Morse Code is somewhat different than the international code that radio amateurs use. As originally conceived, it had, first of all, spaced characters. For example, didadit is R in the international code that's used by radio amateurs in the maritime services and the militaries and so forth. But in the American Morse code, that would be an F. And likewise, an R in American Morse code would actually be dit. It'd actually have an internal space that's internal to the character. And so there's about, 10 or so of the letters that are different. There's some letters that have alternate meanings. That is, there's some Morse characters that have alternate meanings in the American Morse code. And the numerals are different. And so this is the original Morse code that was developed by Morris and Vail. Now, when they laid the first undersea cables, the spaced characters turned out to be difficult to distinguish. They didn't understand these concepts of, reactants and long undersea cables and, the signal distortions that might occur. And they realized as they worked with the first successful undersea cables that they could not use the original Morse code because they couldn't distinguish the different dash lengths. There's three different dash lengths, and they couldn't distinguish these spaced characters. So a committee meeting was held on the continent of Europe, and it developed what's now called the International Morse Code, or actually, technically, the Continental Code. The Continental Code eliminated the spaced characters, and it eliminated the three different dash lengths that exist in the original American Morse code. And it is the Continental Code that radio amateurs use, and that is generally used throughout the world. Now, about the time that this occurred, the American telegraph industry, that is primarily the U.S., Canada, Mexico, and the like, was so well established that it was impractical to retrain all these telegraph operators in the new international standard. So the American commercial and railroad telegraph industries stayed with the original American Morse code. And this continued to be used in commercial applications into the 1980s when landline or commercial telegraphy was finally eliminated entirely just through technological progress and the like. So, this is a real long and complex way of saying that there are really two American, or there's two Morse codes that were commonly used in North America, one of which is this older American Morse code, and that was used by commercial and railroad telegraphers, say, for example, people who worked for Western Union, Postal Telegraph, the stock brokerages, press services, things of that nature. And then there's also this international Morse code, properly called the Continental Code, which is used by radio amateurs, maritime services, etc. So our organization focuses on the history of the telegraph industry and telegraphy, and its primary emphasis is this older Morse code. Many of our members are retired from the railroad and commercial telegraph industry, and then, of course, we have people who are also members because they're amateur historians or professional historians, or they're radio amateurs, and they want to learn about the history of telegraphy, how it evolved, and the whole historical foundation for Morris and the like. So that sort of describes the foundation of the Morris Telegraph Club and gives a little bit of background into why, it's a unique organization.
So at this point in time, in your organization, how many people do you think there are that are non-radio amateurs that are members and participate in the activities?
I would have to estimate that, but I would say probably about 30 to 40% were primarily commercial or railroad telegraph operators. The remaining membership is, radio amateurs, historians, people of that nature that have an interest in the technology. Now, keep in mind that many of the people who worked in the commercial and railroad telegraph industry are what you might call bilingual. They also served in, say, World War II, et cetera, and they were trained also in the Continental Code. But their primary background in telegraphy is related to working in the railroad or commercial telegraph industry.
So is it, if a person is very familiar with and does, say they're proficient at CW at whatever speed, okay, if someone starts sending the other code to them, how confusing does it get? I mean, if there's only a few characters that are out, it seems to me that would have almost little relevance. In other words, I think you'd wind up getting 90% of the content anyhow.
Well, I think that certainly someone who's proficient in international code, that is, by proficient I mean he can treat it as a language. You'll find that as one learns telegraphy, whatever version it is, you go from essentially the initial phase where you're sort of translating in your head, and then over time it evolves into a natural language, and that's the point where, say, an operator can copy in his head, treat it just like he would the spoken language. He can only, only maybe write down or make notes about information that's necessary, but essentially he listens to Morris in the same way he does to a natural language, and he comprehends it in the same manner. So that's what I would call a proficient operator. An operator at that stage can learn American Morris quite easily. It usually just takes, a few weeks of study. Now, keep in mind that some of the letters are different. Some of them have alternate meanings, which really can confuse a guy. For example, a J in American Morris code is da-da-da-dit. And R is the dot, and so on. And so, and then, of course, you have the spaced characters. Y is did it, Z is did it. And so this can really throw off an operator, particularly as operators go up in speed. They tend to hear whole words. They tend to hear whole patterns. And so there is some effort involved in picking up the American Morris code, but certainly a proficient operator can do it with relative ease. I mean, you have to put a little effort in, but, one can learn it, and they can become quite proficient and comfortable with it.
Well, I know back they were giving the live CW exams on the FCC tests. What they did at that particular, there was different methods by which they did it, but at the period of time when I took the test, they sent an entire section or a whole QSO. And then they would give you a multiple choice test. Said, what was the guy's name, and what was his QTH, and what was the signal of one person? And they would ask these. I mean, you had to know the answers. I mean, there's no way you could fake it. But you didn't have to know. Let's put it this way: if you missed a few characters here and there, that wasn't counted against you because they were asking you about the text. Prior to that, I understand that. The CW test was given differently in that you were held accountable to every character. And that was before my time. So I wondered about that. And then it dawned on me, and especially when you get on and you start operating, there's distractions and different things that come down the pike, and you miss characters all over the place. But yet, when you look down at the paper, you know exactly what the person's saying. If you're copying to paper. I always had to copy to paper. I could never copy in my head. But, if somebody were to sit there and rattle off letters to me, I couldn't keep those in my head either. if someone was sitting there going C-A-T-D-O-G, it's what? I'd have to write it down, brain is slow.
Right.
But that, you know, I wondered about that because the different. But I guess it would throw me off if I heard that kind of a C. If I wasn't hearing da da da, I'd be thinking something else. You know, I'd be, what was that? You know, and then I think I would be thinking, what was that? To the point I'd miss the next 20 characters. You know, so.
Oh, well, yeah, and this is...
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and our guest is James Wades with the Morse Telegraph Club, WB8SIW. We'll be back right after this. A lot of radio amateurs get a big bang out of building antennas and experimenting, and I think we all do from time to time. But there comes a time when you're just dead serious about making contacts, and you want the antenna to be right. You want it to be a professionally designed, optimized piece of workhorse gear that's going to reach out there and do exactly what you want it to do. And you and the experimenting's over with. You're serious about operating. You're serious about contesting. You know, you're serious about working satellites or doing moon bounce, or maybe you're going on a de-expedition and you want to put up an array. Now, I'm not talking about a portable antenna. I'm talking about an array. You want to put something on a tower that's big, that works. If you're looking for that kind of an antenna system, there's one place to look, and that's M Squared Antennas. M Squared, their website is simply M2Inc.com. That's M2, and then Inc.com, M2Inc.com, M Squared Antennas. What you're going to find is HF monobanders. You're going to find HF log periodics. You're going to find HF multibanders, 6-meter antennas, 2-meter antennas, 220 megahertz antennas, 440, 902 to S-band. You're going to find their horizontal Omni, the thing that, boy, I'll tell you what, you're working moon bounce. You want to work moon bounce and you want to work satellites. They've got it knocked. They've got all the EME products you could possibly imagine. They have preamps. They have rotators. They have rotator controls. They've got phasing cables. I mean, they've got it all figured out, including preamps and solid-state amplifiers. Now, if that's what you're into, that's it. I'm telling you, one place to go, M Squared Antennas. Once again, their website is M2Inc.com. That's M, followed by the numeral 2, Inc.com. Or you can go to our website, QSORadioShow.com. Go to their website, take a look around, and you know what? You can pick up the phone and you can call them and ask them questions about what it is you're trying to do, and they'll tell you what you need, and they'll work with you. M Squared Antennas. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see, get their ticket. Give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Hamtest Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Hamtest Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamtestOnline.com. That's HamtestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the QSO Radio Show. And notice I said radio. We come to you over the air. That's right. We are a radio show. But we also have this program available in podcast form should you miss a certain portion of it. And you can find that at QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, TedRandall, TedRandall.com. And we just want to let you know that. But first and foremost, we come over HF Radio to you, because that's what we like the best, and that's the way it really ought to be. We ought to come to you by means of HF Radio, and that's what we do. So thank you for tuning in, and now let's get back to our guest, James Wades, with the Morse Telegraph Club, WB8SIW.
There's another difference, too, and that is landline telegraphy did not use tone. You've probably seen the telegraphy is typically poorly represented in most movies, but you've probably seen, movies where you maybe see a telegraph sounder. And a telegraph sounder, of course, you listen to it a different. You essentially listen to the report of two different clicks. I don't know if you can hear this over the telephone here, but I will send some dots and some dashes on a telegraph sounder, and you can let me know how they come out here. Hold on just a minute.
All right.
Okay, these are going to be some dots. Okay. And these will be dashes. Okay, can you hear the difference
there? Right, we had a little bit of a telephone line distortion there for a second. So why don't you go ahead and send some more dots and then send a series of dashes again.
Okay. Those are dots and dashes, and the American are on a telegraph sounder.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's different. You know, I mean, yeah, and we've all heard that in movies, and it represented like that maybe in historical documentaries and things like that. But I wonder how many guys have actually sat down and tried to copy code off of a sounder. You know,
and of course it is different, even with the Continental code, people. Typically can't instantly copy off of a sounder. They have to learn, to distinguish the patterns. So it's not only different copying from a sounder, but then, of course, in commercial telegraphy or railroad telegraphy, the sound is different. So, as a person is sending, the quick brown fox, that's the quick brown fox in American Morse code. I don't know how that came out, but it's a different.
We can hear it quite well, but that is just like totally confusing to me. That would take a tremendous amount of practice. But I bet any amount of money that if you get into it though, and you really put some effort forth, it would come rather quickly once you started catching on to it. If you know, in other words, if you know the code, you've been listening to tones. I think it would be, it would not be a horribly difficult thing to convert to the sound of a sounder. In other words, when I was a kid, boy, we used to send CW with pencils in the classroom.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, if you if you already know the Continental Code, yeah, and you know you want to learn to copy on a sounder, it just takes maybe a day or two. The easy way to do it, actually, to learn how to copy Continental Code on a sounder, is to there's on our webpage, there is what's called a tone converter schematic. You can build up a little circuit that will drive a sounder from the output of a communications receiver. So what you do is you build up this little circuit and you connect it up to a telegraph sounder, and then what you do is you listen to both tone and the sounder simultaneously. Different QSOs, maybe a CW net, you know, something of that nature. And over time, you just turn down the volume on the receiver, and in a matter of a day or two, you can be copying the international code, you know, the Continental Code on a telegraph sounder. So that's the first step, really. And then, if you want to learn the American Morse, you can learn the variations in the character set and pick it up in a few weeks.
Oh, that's absolutely incredible. I'm sitting here thinking to myself, that a ham radio absolutely totally amazes me, and that is the fact that, you know, when you think about what you folks are doing, this is a whole different realm, and I can see folks just getting caught away in this, you know, completely caught away. But let's talk about Morse, and let's talk about CW for just a little bit. You know, back years ago, obviously the code was a dreaded thing. Well, you got to learn the code. You know, you just got to learn it. If you can't get that license, all the code. And a lot of folks, I think, really approached it that way. But what I found was weird is that once everybody got a novice ticket, and they wanted to get on the air, and once they got on the air, all that changed. The minute they started sending and receiving QSL cards in the middle of the novice bands, you know, running 75 watts or whatever it was, they would just get caught away with it. I mean, it was like it was a different world. And I think today, I want to say I don't think that, you know, the lack of the code is killing the hobby, but I think what it has done is it's taken away a complete, total set of magic experiences from the hams that get into the hobby and never experience that. To know that, well, you know, I mean, when I had the novice, I got to the point I didn't care about having a microphone. I mean, I was having so much fun making contacts with people all over the place, and I was no speed demon. But it was just something magic about it. I remember I could hardly wait to get home after school to sit down in front of the radio, you know, and be listening up and down. There wasn't a whole lot of space just on the novice bands. I mean, it was, you know, I don't know how wide they were. I can't remember now. 3,700 to, well, 30, was it 3,700 to 3,750 on 80 meters, I think. I don't know. I may have that wrong.
That's correct.
You know,
yeah.
Well, I remember that was kind of where I hung out. I liked the 80 meter band. And, man, I mean, it was just like so much fun. And those QSL cards would come in the mail, you know. And, but I think there's something missing today. This is something I think people would get into CW, experience it, but I don't think it's still the same. That when you experience it at an entry level, when you are coming into the hobby, and all of a sudden you get turned on to this magic, you know, and it really is magic. I mean, it just, you have to be there. You have to do it. You know, there's no other way to describe it. But anyways, what do you think? I mean, you obviously are a CW freak, you know, so tell me about this. Am I right about this, or am I off base somewhere?
No, I think you've hit on a very essential point, and that is, you know, what differentiates CW from other modes? And the conclusion I've reached is that fundamentally it's an art form. And there's something about art forms that provide a lasting and meaningful challenge to people that maintains their interest. So you'll find people who have operated CW for 10, 20, 30, 50, 70 years, And whereas you find a lot of people, what they'll do if they didn't come in with Morris or they didn't get involved in CW in the hobby, they buy an expensive radio. Perhaps they set it up for some of the digital modes. And, you know, after they've used it for a period of time, they kind of lose interest. It loses some of its luster. It's almost like buying a new car. You know, you go off to a car lot, you buy a new car, you drive it off the lot, it has that new car smell, it looks nice. But after a year, it's just four wheels and an engine. Okay, so, you know, amateur radio can be like that. You can buy a state-of-the-art transceiver and plug in a microphone or hook up one of the digital modes, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. That's, if that's what interests you and that's what maintains your interest, I support it 100%. But I think there's a lot of people over time where that kind of luster, and after a while, it's sort of just another appliance. Whereas with radio telegraphy, you are engaged in an art form, and it's always there's always the challenge of sending better, receiving faster, being a more proficient operator in terms of how you use the cue signals and, you know, the procedural signs and so forth. And in a way, it's a lifetime challenge. A good analogy from my personal experience, I like fly fishing. Okay, now, a lot of people go out with a spin casting outfit, and, you know, they have a good time. They toss a lure in the water, they catch fish. Hey, that's great. You know, you're getting an appreciation of the outdoors and all. But there's something about the aesthetics and the rhythm and the art of fly fishing. And it's really a whole science and an art form all rolled into one. So I enjoy the art of fly casting and how you present the fly and how you match the hatch and all this kind of thing. And most fly fishermen will tell you that's part of the lasting interest in it. So I guess the point I would make is that if you've never considered CW, you have to kind of look at it not so much as a technology, but it's really an art form. And it's an art form that's unique to amateur radio. And it provides a certain lasting satisfaction that you don't necessarily get out of simply buying a radio, hooking up a commercial antenna, plugging in a microphone and talking. And that's the best analogy I can offer.
Well, you know, one of the things about phone, and that is, I think that we allow phone communications to become mundane. And we become the phone conversations that take place on ham radio actually become very selfish in nature. In other words, you hear it. You know, you get, and I don't know, you get these round tables going. I don't even call them round tables. I guess I'd say watering holes, where these guys meet up at on certain frequencies, you know, and they claim the frequency. In some cases, they reject any outsiders whatsoever, which I think goes totally, completely against the grain of the intention of the hobby. To me, it's like a closed repeater system. It's the same thing. It goes against the grain of the intention of the hobby. You know, and I don't even, I don't apologize for saying that. That's just the way it is, you know. But in CW, it seems to me like the conversations are more, and I don't want to say to the point, it just seems like it's a higher quality communication. I go back to the novice days, you know, and I'd get the guy's name. I'd get his QTH. We'd exchange signal reports. And then I'd ask him. Because of a friend of mine that introduced me to ham radio, an older guy that the first ever I ever saw amateur radio operating was a guy in Dearborn, and his name was Nelson Cosby. I don't know if you have ever heard of him. I can't remember his call sign. But he took me into the shack, and I saw amateur radio working, and he's working on a 20-meter beam to a guy out in Denver. It's the first time I'd ever seen this thing happening. And he told me, he said, on my log here, and he kept a pretty impeccable log, everybody he talked to, and he said, I always ask them what their occupation is. And I sat there and I looked at that log and it just blew my mind. It's like, look at all these different people that do all these different things. And so I know when I was a novice, that was one of the very first things I did, is I would always ask what the person's QTH was. And it just seems like you really actually got to know more about people that way than I hear today taking place on phone. It just seems like they would get into more detail. I have three children. My wife's name is so and so. You know, I'm this old. You know, I do this for a living. I mean, it was just amazing. And then you say, "What's your background?" The guy come back with that. It was the type of conversation was so informative. But by the time you got done, you felt like you knew the guy. But I mean, every time I was just absolutely amazed at the people that I was contacting, the people who were talking to me, and the people who were. The information they were giving me, I was thinking, man, this is unbelievable. You know, it just seems, I think maybe that's part of the element that's missing as well. I don't know. I mean, do you ever feel like when you get on phone that it's just kind of shallow at times? I feel like it's just, something, you know, it's easy to talk to someone and you hear the human voice. But it also seems to me that there's not much effort placed into phone conversations. And what I mean by that is you don't hear people asking questions of the other guy. You know, you don't hear, it's all about me. And I thought, well, you know, it doesn't make sense because I know all about me. I don't know all about him. I should be asking him questions. You know, there should be an exchange of information as you kind of get acquainted with each other. But that seems to be lost. Now tell me I'm just an old sourpuss here and I'm negative and I'm a curmudgeon. What do you think?
Well, my first response might be I resemble that remark, but I think, you know, it's kind of interesting. If you analyze CW versus phone, I think there's a certain dynamic at work that most people don't perceive, and I think it's largely subconscious. And in saying that, I guess what I'm trying to say is when one operates CW, there's a perception, it may even be just subconscious, that one has limited circuit capacity. In other words, there's some effort involved in what you say. There's a perception that it takes longer to say things. And I think there's a tendency to try and convey the most consequential information in the most limited amount of time practical. So in a way, there's the operator trends toward a certain economy of language, a certain emphasis on the things that are important, and I believe that's largely subconscious because there's the perception that it takes longer to do things, and there's the perception that limited circuit capacity exists. Voice, on the other hand, is so natural. It gives the perception that there's plenty of circuit capacity and plenty of time, and people don't weigh their conversations as carefully. They sort of engage in this thinking aloud process, and they sort of, it's almost a stream of consciousness kind of thing where they say whatever comes into their mind, and they really don't engage in what you might call a gatekeeping process. Is this important enough to transmit? Is this important enough to say? So I think there is that dynamic at work, and that, you know, CW operators tend to, just by the nature of the medium, they tend to say, okay, what's important? What do I really want to tell this person? What do I really want to find out from this person? Because, again, you do have to choose your words wisely and engage in a certain economy of language. So it's a different medium, and the medium influences perceptions and how the person exchanges information. A good example of that in a different environment is traffic nets. What you'll find is that on average, a CW traffic net will handle anywhere from 3 to 4 times more messages per hour than a radio telephone net. Now you think about it, the average person can talk at, you know, several hundred words per minute. A competent CW operator can maybe transmit at 35, 40 words a minute. So why is it that a CW net can clear more traffic often than a voice net? And there's a variety of reasons, but one of the components is the fact that the CW operator trends toward a certain economy of communications. He picks up a string of messages. Instead of saying, making comments between them, he sends a simple dit to let the transmitting operator know he received the message okay. He uses abbreviations. He sends as little extraneous information as possible. If you listen to a voice net, say on 20 meters during an emergency, you will hear a lot of unnecessary communications because the perception exists because it's voice, because it's natural, I have plenty of time to say whatever I want. And so as a result, communications is actually less efficient because, you know, there's this, again, perception that there's plenty of circuit capacity. It's not truly the case, but nonetheless, that's the difference, I think, between the way a CW operator approaches communications and a voice operator approaches communications. I hope that makes sense.
It's almost like a conscious conservation without thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, look at email communications in your typical, you know, I work for a company and I get plenty of emails, you know, at the office. And look at the amount of extraneous information that you get in the course of a workday and how much of that information is really important or essential. And you'll find that much of it is not. And that's why I kind of joke that, you know, the telegraph companies had the right idea. They charged by the word. When people were charged by the word to send important business communications, they used a certain economy of language, and they conveyed just information that they considered important.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that I'm thinking of is when you were talking about phone, and you said that there isn't much conscious effort made toward choosing words, and is this important enough to say on the air, and do we really want to say this on the air? Boy, you know, I couldn't agree more with that, because some of the stuff that you hear on the air today would curl your hair. You know, I mean, it never would take place 20 years ago. It takes place now. And I wonder what goes through people's minds. Why do they engage in that? What's the purpose of that? In other words, you want to promote the hobby. You want the hobby to look good in the eyes of all who may listen. And you don't know who's listening. You know, you don't know who's out there actually, you know, tuning you in on a radio and hearing, you know, all the things that you're saying. And with that in mind, it just seems to me that it would become paramount important to choose words carefully, to make what you're actually doing on the air, not just make it yourself, which it is yourself and being natural, but also make it, you know, a presentation, because in reality, that's really what it is.
Yeah, I would agree. I think radio amateurs need to always keep in mind that, you know, amateur radio isn't just a hobby. It's a service. I mean, it exists for a reason. It's held to a somewhat higher standard because you're allowed to use a public resource in order to engage in your hobby or the avocation of amateur radio. So, absolutely need to weigh carefully what you say on the air and how that's perceived by, say, the average shortwave radio listener, or for that matter, a regulatory body, may be responsible for allocating, you know, spectrum to the amateur radio service. Now, certainly amateur radio justifies its existence in many ways, emergency communications and so forth, but nonetheless, I think we do need to always keep in mind that we have a responsibility to consider how we're perceived, and we also have to recognize that our individual actions set a tone for the hobby, and that, you know, collectively, you know, if you take into account sort of the aggregate of all the different behaviors on the bands, those all set a certain tone that represents amateur radio. So, yes, you can look at things from a very self-centered perspective. Well, this is me, and this is what I want to say, and, you know, this is what I want to do today. But you take 500 people that are engaging in that attitude, and then you've set a tone for amateur radio that's perhaps problematic. So, absolutely, I think you have a duty to the amateur radio community as a licensee to set a positive, constructive tone in all of your communications.
Well, I want to get back on track here with you and your organization, because I was what you have here, though, from what I can see and what I understand, one of the things you're into is museum projects. I can see that, and that looks interesting. But what about this this KOB network? How does that work? And I know you've got some software, and it looks to me like you guys have a network of telegraph stations set up all over the country. And I want you to tell us how this works, because this sounds like it's, first off, it's independent of ham radio, it sounds like. And tell me about that. This sounds really interesting. I didn't even know this existed.
Yeah, this kind of has a history to it as well. The Morse Telegraph Club was built on a chapter basis. So, for example, you have different chapters throughout the United States. For example, I'm a member of the Toledo chapter of the Morse Telegraph Club. And, of course, when men retired from the telegraph industry, they have this skill and that they wanted to continue to practice and enjoy using. And so in the 1950s or early 1960s, 1970s, it was very common for chapters to lease a telegraph wire from the phone company. And they would actually have a current loop and a telegraph circuit provided by AT&T in their homes by the Bell system. And they would get on the wire and they would chat just much as radio amateurs do on the air. And, we often forget that the phone company was one of the biggest users of telegraphy. they used it for a lot of their internal company communications and for private wire services and things of this nature. So really up until maybe the 1980s, one could get a telegraph loop, actual current loop provided by the phone company. Now, of course, with advances in technology, that went away. And we had a gentleman in our club who was retired from AT&T, and his name was Ace Holman. And Ace Holman built a hub system, which essentially worked on the principles of the Bell 103 modem. And he hand-built a system with an auto-answer frame and a set of modems. And what one would do is he would create a telegraph current loop to operate as telegraph sounders, as relays, as keys, etc., and through a special interface circuit that would connect to a modem. Then the modem would connect to this telegraph hub that Ace Holman created. And that would allow multiple telegraph offices to interconnect via the telephone network, much the way you would do with a computer modem. And you could have a number of telegraph operators all connected to the hub, and their instruments would behave just like they would on a traditional telegraph circuit. The hub systems still operate. We have one serving the United States, and we have one serving Canada. And they're still used by some of our members. Recently, one of our members, a gentleman named Les Kerr, developed a system called Morse KOB. Essentially, you can download some free software, and this software utilizes the Internet to replicate the functions of a telegraph wire. And you build a small interface circuit that interfaces your local current loop that operates your telegraph instruments, and it interfaces it with the serial port on your computer, and then the software simulates the telegraph wire. And you can have almost an unlimited number of telegraph offices connected into the Morse KOB network, and there's multiple wires that are available. There's also news broadcasts that are available where they transmit, for example, AP News and so forth, via in Morse, American Morse code at different speeds. Code practice is available and so forth. And that's all available for free online, along with instructions and other information on how to use the system. And that's part of the Morse Telegraph Club's activities. And so there's quite a few people now using this new Morse KOB system. And what's neat about it is if you were to bring a telegraph operator from the past, so say maybe he was around 75 years ago or 50 years ago, and you sat him down in front of the instruments, he could not detect that a computer is involved. The instruments operate just as they would on a regular telegraph circuit. It's a normally closed loop system. You have to open your key to transmit, et cetera, et cetera. But it essentially simulates a telegraph line using the Internet. And we've been using this system for telegraph demonstrations. We have because it's the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Civil War, we've had quite a few special museum exhibits that have incorporated telegraphy. And we've actually put in operation an 1860s newswire, which transmits Civil War era news bulletins from exactly 150 years ago. And they can display on a computer screen and operate the sounder for the correct American Morse code at a public museum so people can kind of see how telegraphy worked, and you know, see how you know what it would have been like to receive a news bulletin back in the 1860s by Morse code. So there's a lot of things you can do with this Morse KOB system, and it's a great way to learn telegraphy and you know actually use the antique instruments in a very interactive way.
Well, I want to ask this question for the folks that are, would be interested in, saying, in getting involved in this. Now, I would say the purist is going to want to run the instruments that you're talking about. Is it possible, though, for someone who is, I guess I want to say, used to Morse code and tone to monitor and participate in this, but instead of using the instruments, use tones instead? I mean, does anyone do that, or is that... is that considered a violation of?
Well, no, I don't think so. The biggest problem that you run into in North American telegraph practice, the telegraph loop is a normally closed loop. So, for example, if you've got in a very simple context, let's say you have two telegraph offices, and they're interconnected by the telegraph loop. When no business is being conducted, both keys are closed. Okay, that, if you ever look at a telegraph key, you see a lot of them have that little switch on the side.
Oh, yeah.
That shorts out the key. You know, radio amateurs believe that was incorporated into keys to allow them to tune up their transmitters. Well, that's not really the case. So that was really put on the telegraph key to keep the key closed when you're receiving or no communication. Transmitting, there's always current flowing through the instruments. And when one office wants to transmit, he unshorts his key, opens up that circuit closing switch, and then sounders open up, and then he can hear, you know, he can start transmitting or calling the other stations. Now, one can take a telegraph relay and put it in that circuit, and then, of course, connect the output of the telegraph relay, for example, to a code oscillator. And he could copy and tone just fine, but he has to keep in mind that, when nobody's using the wire, he needs to turn off the code oscillator, otherwise it'll squeal continuously and get rather annoying. But certainly, you know, there's nothing to prevent an operator from, somebody new from wanting to first maybe listen and tone, using a small telegraph relay or something to actuate a code oscillator. We have some people who participate in the network from Australia and New Zealand. Now, in Australia, for example, in New Zealand, they use the international code on commercial telegraph circuits, and they're more comfortable with, even though they're using a sounder, they're more comfortable with the international code, and us, you know, we'll occasionally chat with them in international code. So, we welcome anybody that has a genuine interest in learning Morse and being involved in the Morse Telegraph Club. Keep in mind our primary focus is perpetuating the history and traditions of the telegraph industry. So our primary emphasis is of course American Morse code, but we have a wire dedicated to primarily slower operators, people who are new to the code, and we will do everything that we can to accommodate somebody that wants to get involved and learn Morse.
Well, now, when you say you have a slow wire, what do you consider slow?
Well, slow would be, here's my recommendation. You know, if you're a radio amateur, it's best to first become comfortable and proficient with the international code. That way it's intuitive, you're not trying to learn two different codes simultaneously, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say you probably don't want to learn American Morse code until you're already comfortable with the international code, maybe where you can operate 15, 18, 20 words a minute, or more. And, you're pretty comfortable with the code. That way you won't get confused. You won't run into problems. But provided you have some background in CW and you're pretty comfortable with it, we'll slow down to whatever speed the operator is sending at. somebody wants to get on the wire and learn Morris, and he operates at 10 words a minute or 15 words a minute, we'll slow down to 10 or 15 words a minute. You will hear guys on there who operate at, you know, 30, 35, 40 words a minute, of course, because this was their profession. You know, they operate quickly, or they're very good operators. But, you know, certainly it's just like on the ham bands. If you hear a guy calling CQ at 5 words a minute, you should answer him at 5 words a minute. and we operate on the same basic principle.
I wondered about that because, you know, I can go back once again to novice days, and I can talk about the fact that once I got on the air, the craziest thing was is I never really ever thought about speed. It just never entered my mind. In other words, I'd look for somebody that I could copy, or I'd call CQ and they'd come back, and you know, sometimes I'd have to tell the guy slow down a bit here. But it was just never. It was like this never this push, you know, for speed. It was more you got caught away with the communications, and I think you can get caught away with the communications to the point where you don't think about the fact that you're limited because you're on CW. It doesn't enter your mind. It you're just in a different world, you know. But then I noticed it wasn't very long at all. I sat down and looked at my code speed, and I thought, oh, my God. You know, I can't believe I was moving right at 20 words a minute, you know, and had done it unconsciously, hadn't even given it 1 minute's thought. I mean, just I was just there, didn't realize it. And I didn't realize it until one day I was tuning down the band, and I was listening to somebody, and this guy was creeping along, you know, and I went back to him, and I thought, boy, this guy's going slow. And I started timing the characters as to how many characters were coming across per minute, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought, you know, he's doing 6 words a minute, you know, and obviously he's just starting. But it hadn't been that long ago. I was creeping along at 6 words a minute, you know. So I think when you're having fun, you know, the speed comes, it just comes. I mean, I know there's probably guys that really try to push the speed thing because it's a goal, you know, to get to a certain level, you know. But I think that for most guys, the speed goes up as you start having fun. You know, it just comes. Is that a true statement, or is that just my false impression, I guess?
No, I think that's absolutely true. The best way to learn the code is to get on the air and use it, and the speed then comes naturally. And I think one of the things that may have back when you had the 13 words per minute for the general class license and 20 words per minute for the extra, probably one of the things that turned people off is, of course, they set that goal, and then they, of course, had to study and study and practice in order to get up to that speed, in order to get the license, and it became work to them. Whereas today, you know, if you have an interest in CW, you get on the air, you have to, obviously, there's some study and practice you have to do up front. You can't go on the air at 0 words a minute, you know. But you know, once you're on the air, you can find people to talk to, and you can start slow. And that's exactly what happens over time. You begin to increase in speed, and there's always somebody who will challenge you a little bit, maybe by sending a little, you know, at the upper edge of your capability, and you'll find that you meet that, you know, that level with a little bit of difficulty. But next time you get on, it's a little easier, and then maybe you run into somebody who's slightly faster. And over time, your speed creeps up, and that's the way to learn code, where you're not under pressure. You're not sitting in front of the FCC examiner, and you have to have a minute of solid copy. When I took my license exams, they didn't have the QSO format. I remember, I think, my general license, it was a maritime bulletin with latitude and longitude and, you know, hurricane, you know, located at this thing, and barometric pressure and all this, and you had to have a minute of solid copy. And then you had to, and then, of course, you had to send for the FCC district engineer as well. He would sit you down in front of the key, and you had to send Morris to his satisfaction. And then if you didn't pass the code, or if you passed the code test, then you could take the, you know, the theory test. And that made it a lot of work for people. I think some people kind of resented that, and it turned them off to the code. Today it's easy. You know, you practice at your own pace. You're already on the air. You can get on the air with a friend and you know, work your speed up to sort of a basic level, and then start having QSOs. And it's a good time. You know, it's much easier.
I want to just move off this just for a moment, because we got with the folks that we talk to on the air that are into that are hams and amateur radio, and especially with the situation you have here with the with this Morse Club and the promotion of the traditional practice of Morse code using sounders and all that kind of thing, which is just so fascinating. Let's go back in time a little bit and tell me how it is that you wound up getting involved or getting interested in amateur radio.
Well, I had an exposure to, of course, through the railroad to telegraphy as a youngster. And then it so happens my father flew combat in the Second World War, and he went to a we were on a family vacation, and we dropped in to visit a gentleman named Marvin Wilnaw, who was a pilot in his B-17 crew, and an interesting man. He'd won the Distinguished Flying Cross from World War II, just as an aside. But anyway, it turns out that Mr. Wilnaw's neighbor was a ham operator. And he found out from my father that I had an interest in electronics and radios, and he took me next door, and this gentleman had a homebrew transmitter, big rack and panel transmitter, and a Hallicrafter's receiver, and he let me talk to somebody on voice, and I was so impressed. Of course, I realized then and there I had to get a ham license, and so then I happened to be at the library a couple of months later, and I found a book by Howard Pyle, entitled So You Want to Be a Ham. And anyway, so I bought the book, and I guess the rest is history. I got an instructograph, learned international code on the instructograph, and they had a class at the local adult education, through the city, where a gentleman named Jerry Blumenthal over in Southfield was, providing the novice class, study and exams. And so I got my novice license and then, continued to be active in ham radio sense. And I always enjoyed ham radio. It's been pretty much a constant, in my life for many years. I've enjoyed it immensely. And that's how I got involved in ham radio.
Well, now let me ask this question. Now, how you got involved in ham radio, but that had to be a major influence in you getting involved in broadcast radio engineering and television.
Yeah, I did get involved in radio and TV broadcasting, and I think I did so again because of the interest in electronics. And RF systems and antenna theory and so forth. It was kind of a natural fit to go from homebrewing ham radio equipment and things of that nature to maintaining broadcast stations. The components are bigger, but the fundamentals are the same. And I think this continues to be one of the real potentially valuable things about ham radio is that it does introduce people to these concepts of RF systems and radio wave propagation and communications and antennas and transmission line theory and so forth. And so, it was real natural for me to move into radio and TV. And I worked in the industry for about 15 years in the Detroit metropolitan area and enjoyed it very much.
Well, what was your first commercial broadcast job, engineering-wise?
I took a job as assistant chief engineer for WNIC in Detroit. That was the first job in radio and TV. That was the old Keener 13, 1300 AM, and of course a WNIC FM broadcast facility, which many people from the Detroit area will remember. Those two stations.
Now let me ask a question: is this the same? I probably would have asked you this before we went on the air, but we didn't go down this road yet. WNIC FM. Was that at that time going back when I was involved in broadcast radio in Detroit? That transmitter was located on another tower. The station at that time was WBFG, and it was down on, I believe, Linden Avenue. And at that time, believe it or not, it was Keener FM, WKNR FM. And it was located in a little building, the transmitter was, underneath that tower, which was a self-supporting tower on Linden. I'm curious, is this the same FM, or is something, was something changed since then?
That was the older transmitter site. They ended up building a new transmitter site, if I recall correctly, right next door, right off close to that. And that was the transmitter site that was in operation when I was there.
No, you dropped out there for a second. You said they built a building. Where at?
Right nearby at Schoolcraft and Turner.
Okay.
Area in Detroit. Not very nice neighborhood these days. But
now was
anyway,
that?
That was
on a different tower at that point.
That's correct.
Okay. I didn't know. Because that tower, if I remember right, that tower that WBFG occupied, and at that time Keener FM, it seems to me, that was, somebody told me that was the old WJBK television tower for Channel 2 years ago. Now, that might not be correct, but it seems like that's what the original purpose.
Yeah, and I don't recall for sure to be honest, but it's been quite a few years.
Well, you know, WBFG originally existed in Allen Park, Michigan, back behind Gilead Baptist Church. And I'm kind of thinking of the guy's name. I think it was Parr that owned it. Some guy, his last name was Parr, but anyways, the thing was sold purchased by a group, Trinity Broadcasting, which was the Nanowski brothers, and then they moved it down to Linden Avenue. And it seems like they raised power, too. I don't know. All that fuzzes out in my head because it's been so long. But I wondered about that, because that station actually, during its heyday, had a very colorful character on the air by the name of Russ Gibb. I don't know if you remember him. They called him Uncle Russ. He owned the Grandy Ballroom, and he started the rumor, one of the Beatles rumors or something, that circled the globe. He became famous, but wow, what a
character. Or whatever.
Yeah, he was really entertaining on the air, though. He had a very laid-back kind of thing, and you know, he just knew exactly what to do to connect with the radio audience. But because at that time, I think, there was another station in town that at that time, I think, Keener FM was trying to compete against, and that was WABX. They had gone underground, you know.
That's right. Yeah, it was real the acid rock station, so to speak.
Yeah, they were on the 33rd floor of the David Stott building. I remember going up there, and the oddest thing was the windows in the place would open up, and they would go up, and the window would go like almost from the ceiling all the way to the floor. So once they opened the windows, you could just literally walk out, drop 30-something floors, you know. And in the condition that those guys were in most of the time, I'm surprised there wasn't some deaths in that place. But evidently, everybody stayed on board. Nobody jumped ship out those windows. But I looked at those windows, and I thought, wow, you know, this is insane. Of course, today they wouldn't allow that. They'd have to have all sorts of barricades and everything up there. But that was something. Detroit radio, though, was always so interesting. Now, you were at... you were at NIC, and I lived in Dearborn Heights at the time, so the 1310 signal was really good where I lived. But then I'm told that, you know, in other parts of town, it just wasn't so hot, you know, because of the directional array. You could hear it. Actually, someone was telling me that you used to be able to hear the station all the way south and into Toledo, but you couldn't hear it on the west side of Detroit at night. So
yeah, if I recall correctly, it had a very much... the major lobe went straight north, sort of right up Southfield Freeway and Telegraph. And, you know, if you just imagine it going straight north out of Detroit, as a matter of fact, when I worked there, we used to get quite a few QSL cards from shortwave or broadcast, you know, DXers in Scandinavia, which went straight north, I guess, right over the pole. And we would get quite a few DX reports. In the wintertime primarily, you know, from Scandinavia.
But, you know, that's interesting because I'm sure you're familiar with the old WJBK AM in the Detroit area. Originally, was that thing not 12 towers?
Yes, it was. That was, I don't remember the exact details. I believe it was Mr. Storer.
Storer Broadcasting.
Right.
They wanted to go 50,000 watts so that they could get the agency business, you know. So,
That's correct. Yep. And he So they designed this, you know, massive tower array, and I worked on it a few times myself, and it was almost non-workable. It was a constant work in progress, I think, for most of the years that they were, you know, that tower array was there. I understand that they've a subsequent owner dismantled part of that array, and it no longer exists in its original format. I believe they dropped their power output. I'm not sure, but...
Well, someone told me they had dropped to 9 towers, and I thought, well, that's more sensible. But the reason I was saying that is I remember one of the engineers said that, and I don't know where they got the reports, but they said airline pilots in Greenland would tune in the 1500 signal out of Detroit, and it was coming from that array. It was so directional. And I know, I mean, west side of Detroit, it just wasn't there. You couldn't hear it. I mean, I thought, well, I thought as a kid, I thought, what's the point of having 50,000 watts, you know? And you know, they called it a pop bottle pattern, and I don't know. I heard all kinds of things. Of course, when they went country, they got the call sign WDEE, and everyone said, yeah, everybody said that that stood for we've done everything else. And but, you know, they were a fairly good rock and roll station in the early days when you had WXYZ, WJBK. You had Keener, and to some degree at that point in time, CKLW was a participant, but they really didn't hit until Drake came along and reprogrammed the station, because it was so, I don't know, it was just so loose, and it was very, very Canadian sounding, you know. They had jingles that would go like Radio 80, stuff like that, you know. It was like, it just didn't sound, you know. But a mystery station, when I say mystery station, because it was the only station I ever heard like this. And we're doing a little Detroit radio history here, and that's okay, because folks that listen to this radio show really love this stuff, just like you and I do. But do you remember in Canada, a radio station, I think it was CHIR and CHYR, Cheer Radio, they called it. And during the...
I do remember that.
During the day, they were on, and I'll probably have this all wrong, during the day they were on 700, and at night they were on 710, or vice versa. I can't remember. They would move 10 KC, maybe 20, I don't know, maybe 720 or 730, but they would move their daytime signal, they'd get off that frequency, change frequencies, and go to another frequency. And and you'd have to tune, they have a little chirping sound, you know, tune to this sound. They did it every day.
I do remember that.
And they were in Leamington. Yeah. They were in Leamington. And I remember going up to that station and seeing it. When I went up there, I was really surprised at how primitive it was, because on the air, they had a pretty fair presentation. They had reverb behind the guys' voices, and they were playing the same music that Keener and CK and everybody else was playing, you know. And but it was just very, very different. But they were pleasant to listen to. It was a very pleasant station. I just remember can't think of the guy's name that was always on in the afternoon, but they were a pretty good bunch to listen to. So if you worked at NIC, what did you do in television? I'm curious about that.
Well, primarily just contract engineering type projects, consulting and, you know, putting in transmitters, things of that nature. And at that point, I had started a contract broadcast engineering business, so I did a little bit of work at pretty much every station, you know, in the area. I worked in Ann Arbor for a time. I worked at some of the stations there, WPAG, WIQB, just a pretty varied background in broadcasting in the area.
Well, a fellow that is a friend of mine that went to New York City and became rich and famous. I guess he's rich. I don't know. Is Jim Kerr, and Jim Kerr worked out at WNRS or WNRZ in Saline. Did you ever frequent that establishment?
Oh yeah. It started out as WOIA. It was a little 500-watt, two-tower directional array in Saline, Michigan,
yep,
which is southwest of Ann Arbor. I went through a number of phases as well, trying to find an audience. I think it originally started out as was intended to be a local community, you know, news and community service station. As a matter of fact, I have a scrapbook somewhere around here with some of the early photos from when the station first went on the air, as well as some funny photos. Like my favorite is one of a news girl in front of a remote van from the 1960s in her white go-go boots and white skirt. It's pretty cute. But they were country for a while, WNRS, and they operated 500 watts DA. They had a Collins 500A transmitter and a little matching phaser cabinet. And I believe it's still there. It's I think it was most recent incarnation. It's WLYB or something of that nature, but it's a liberal talk station serving Ann Arbor.
Well, I recall the FM having an RCA transmitter, a smaller version than what existed at WMUZ in Detroit, the other place I saw the RCA. Of course, now WBFG had the famous blue RCAs that they could... A lot of engineers called them fireboxes. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah, the blowtorch. Yeah, the BTF-10E and the like. Yeah, the original, of course, that was WIQB, it became that at some point anyway. And they had the original FM transmitter site was co-located with WNRS, and the antenna was up on the one of the towers for the little two-tower directional array. And they eventually built a transmitter site out at the corner of, I guess it would have been the southwest corner of Sio Church and Wagner Road, and next to the big gravel pit operation there. And they installed a Continental transmitter, which was a good box. But I remember the BTF-10E as well. As a matter of fact, I got a call one night, chief engineer, I don't remember which station it was anymore in Detroit, but it was one of the FM stations had there. Transmitter atop the Renaissance Center, and it was a BTF-10, I think it was a BTF-10-20, might have been a 20E, I don't remember which BTF series it was, but I believe, of course, it went off the air, and he was home with the flu, and I was asked to go up and see what the problem was, and when I got up there, the transmitter had literally melted down. Apparently, somebody had bypassed the blower interlock at some point in the past. The blower stopped functioning, and the literally melted the PA cavity.
I've seen that happen.
It liquefied the metal.
Yeah, that's
everything in the ancillary equipment rack. You know, the exciter and everything else all burned. And what was really fascinating was that it never set off the fire alarm at the Renaissance Center.
Wow. Well, you know, the RCAs, those blue boxes, like I said, that BFG had, I've seen two or three of those. But did you ever meet a fellow out at, say, it was WOIA, and it seems like the FM was WOIB at the time when they first went on the air. It was like OIA and OIB. They had separate call letters. I remember that much. And then they changed to WNRS, WNRZ, or whatever they called it. And I think they had two sets there. I think they still maintained NRS. And NRZ, I don't think it was like NRS, AM, and FM. You know, I don't know why that was, but a gentleman that ran the place for a while was the name of Dave Carmine. Mean anything to you?
Yeah, I recognize the name. Uh-huh. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he was a little bit before the time I got involved.
He was out there for a while, and Jim Kerr worked there. That's what I was trying to say. He was out there when they were doing Top 40 at the time, and he was on the air. And of course, then he wound up on WPLJ in New York, and I know, all over the place, and I guess he does fill in for Limbaugh. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in a while, but him and Carmine. Of course, he worked at WHMI and Howell, and one of the stations you may be familiar with that I was actually on the air was WSDS in Ypsilanti, 1480. I don't know if you're familiar with that thing.
Oh, yeah. So Sud's Country, I think, was its last incarnation before it went ethnic. But, yeah, I remember WSDS quite well. It was up there on Prospect Road there on the north northwest side of Ypsilanti.
I remember it well. Prospect or Clark Road. I can't remember Clark. Yeah, it seems like it was Clark. But anyways.
Right. Maybe it might have been the corner of Clark and Prospect.
There was
up the road from that Peninsular paper mill.
And then there was another station that I did work for up there, and that was WYNZ, 1520. And I remember that station well because there was a station in Toledo, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, and that was WTTO, and I think they were on 1520. Or they were close by. I don't know. It seems like, but TTO had the two transmitter sites, one transmitter site for day, one transmitter site for night. And I'd never heard of that before. Of course, I was pretty young and naive, but that would just seem like, wow, that's really cool. They got two transmitter sites.
Yeah, that was, if I recall, the nighttime transmitter site was located just across the state line, I believe in like southern Monroe County somewhere. I went and looked at it for a potential buyer, I don't remember what year now, of course. You know, it's been a long time, probably sometime back in the 90s. And the daytime site there, which you could, for a long time was abandoned but still visible off the I-80 expressway there, was abandoned, and they were operating full-time from the nighttime facility. But I'm not sure anybody ever knew about it. It was really a mess, you know, at the time I saw it. But I do remember that. I do remember that station. And, of course, the station in Ypsilanti became WYFC, I think, for a while, a religious broadcast station. And then they've got they eventually upgraded, built a new tower array right next door to Suds. And that became 990. I believe that's now owned by, it's part of the Catholic Radio Broadcast Network, and it's a Catholic station now, and it has a good signal. It works well.
I'll tell you, they talk about grassroots radio, 1480, that country station, WSDS, at that time, even in that period of time, people said, what? And they were thinking Students for a Democratic Society. The thing, they had this little blue van, okay, and I had to live in that thing. It had a tower mounted on the top of the van that you would crank down, and it would fold down and then lock into place, and then you had three or four sections you cranked up in the air. And I'll tell you, it didn't go down the road any more than 20 miles an hour in that thing, because that big tower on the top, the truck leaned as it went down the road. But inside the van was a Sparta board, two turntables, a couple of Criterion cart machines, a complete cart rack with all the racks with all the carts in it, a complete set of 45 RPM records and some LPs. So you had a duplicate of the entire music library they had in the studio. And then there was a generator built into the thing and an air conditioner mounted on the top. I mean, it was decked out. But it was, I mean, the most unusual situation. You'd drive out to this place, you would crank up the tower, fire up the generator, unless you had, you know, electric power you could plug into, and you turned on that Marty transmitter, pointed the Yaggies at the station, and sat there, and you played the records, you played the commercials, you did everything. And, what I'm telling you, though, you talk about something that's fun. I mean, for a young guy, the radio business, I mean, that's like, you know, it's like field day. It's like operating field day every day on broadcast radio. And I just don't see that kind of innovation today. God, these people go out from these broadcast stations. They do remotes on cell phones. Come on, give me a break. I mean, you know, what in the heck is that going to convince anybody of? You know, I'm calling in on my cell phone over here, and you just went. And they do like two breaks an hour. You know, I remember getting the sponsors involved, and they'd come out to that little blue trailer and sit down and or van, and they'd sit down and talk, and we'd chew the fat about stuff. And I mean, people would be pulling off the road and coming in, and they'd do business with the places. They'd sell and move product off the shelf is what we were doing, you know. But we did it by means of a personality kind of thing. Of course, nobody was even thinking about Arbitron or how many points you were up and down. But I noticed one thing. Bob Cook was the guy that owned that station. And but he had a client list that was so loyal. And I can remember their names because we did these regular remotes from a place called Beverly Furniture, Harlow Tire Company, Feaster Auto Sales. Those people, they stayed with that station for the duration. It was like not so many radio stations today enjoy that. They have to go out and find new clients like every 6 months, you know. And these people just stayed on the air because it worked. And he had some characters. There was an older fellow did mornings, and I think he was He went by the name Colonel Jack Wilkerson or something, and I never did quite understand what all the connection was. But he'd been around a while, and people knew him, and they would set up an actual console and turntables and everything in the front showroom of a car dealership. And he would do his show from that dealership showroom every morning. I don't know. I mean, I remember when WWJ had a permanent booth at the Westland Shopping Center. Do you remember that thing?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah.
I don't.
And, you know, there was a time, you know, when remotes were a big deal. It was something special to, you know, for people to see a live, you know, radio broadcast. I think, you know, in the era before, you know, personal communications and technology became so, you know, ubiquitous, you know, the idea of doing a remote from a carpet store or, an auto dealership was considered something unique and special.
Well, I remember back in the days, though, when WKMH, which was 1310, and before they changed call letters to WKNR, and they have an actual remote trailer. You know, it was actually a trailer. They hauled the thing around. And it was set up so that there was all these windows in the front, and the guy on the air would sit there. And then there would be the record spinner fella sitting in the back, and they would play the records and do everything. So it was a show. I mean, it really was. I mean, you went out there, you saw the guy playing the 45 RPM records, and saw all the mechanics that went into doing a radio broadcast, you know. And I think what's happened today is we've just simply lost that. I mean, I think that even if you went out on a location and set everything up and did things totally from there, I still think it would have the same effect it did years ago. As an example, we do QSO live. We do live broadcasting from the Dayton Hamvention. We do it from the Huntsville Hamfest. We do a live broadcast during Field Day. And every time we do these things, we set up everything. A complete remote studio setup with a console, and anything that we play on the air, we play it from that location and everything. And we have crowds. I mean, people show up and they gather around and they watch, you know. And I don't know. I just think that I still think all that's good. I think that could be done. But I don't think no one wants to put the effort into it is what it is. And I don't think it ever – the people that are running these operations are so uncreative it never pops in their mind that maybe going out there and doing two reports an hour on a cell phone, it just doesn't really amount to anything. I don't see how they –
it certainly lacks the romance of broadcasting, doesn't it? Yeah. I think, you know, there's one thing there's a lot of talk, you know, about, of course, the Internet replacing, you know, broadcasting and media. But in reality, there's something that I think broadcasting provides, which the newer media, you know, such as, you know, the Internet-based media doesn't, and that is the sense of the collective experience. When you listen to a, you know, or watch a, you know, say a football game on television, or you listen to a live event on the radio, there's a perception that you're sharing in that experience with, you know, thousands or millions of others. And I think there's something in the nature of man that he is attracted to that collective experience, you know, that he shares with others. And to see a live broadcast and to participate in it, even if it's just being close by and watching it, is a way of being at the center of that collective experience. And I think you're right, that does have a certain appeal that's sort of lacking in our modern media environment. I think the remote has largely gone away, not because it wasn't successful or interesting to people, but because the local retail environment that used to support that activity has largely disappeared with the, you know, advent of, you know, Walmarts and the chain stores of various kinds. There's no longer the local little independent hardware store that'll pay for a remote, or, you know, the local furniture store with its, you know, special sale or grand opening, or, you know, things of that nature. And everything has been, you know, sort of, you know, pushed up to this sort of national level where that kind of access is no longer available, or perhaps the logistics and contractual issues and everything are too complicated to make it happen. But I think, you know, certainly, you know, the idea of broadcasting creating a sense of community. validity is still valid if somebody could find a way to make it work.
Well, you know, I guess the thing that I felt was a point being missed, and that is it's okay to have remotes that are sold like what WSDS did and all that, but then there's another reason, too, and that is like the concept that WWJ had by putting a remote studio in glass at the Westland Shopping Center. You know, in that particular part of town, even though WWJ had been around forever, that really totally increased the awareness level. You went in that mall, and there was this professional radio booth sitting there. And even when it wasn't occupied, even when they weren't on the air, of course, when they were on the air, it came across somewhat spectacular, but even when they weren't there, and you would stroll by, it gave you an awareness of that radio station, and it let you know that, you know, they're here. This is a local station. They're involved in this community. They broadcast out of this shopping center, you know, and they broadcast out of the shopping center, not necessarily due to sponsorship, but for visibility and to be able to connect with the community. And I think that there's something to be said about that. I don't know. I mean, I think that's the real key to it. I think that's become a lost cause, because the more visible you are, the more people connect with you. At least that's the way it seems to me. But
I would agree with you. I think, you know, I think that's a valid point. I mean, in a way, not just in broadcasting, but we've largely lost the sense of local community. People now perceive so much of the world through, you know, the internet, the television, the glowing CRT, if you will, that they really have a difficult time perceiving themselves as you know, participants in a town or a community or a neighborhood. And I think, you know, we're poorer in a way for that.
Well, one thing that I noticed that's just really cool is a group that came up online. It's called Meetup. And it's not an online community. It's a meetup. How would I say it? It is a means, or almost like a bulletin board, where people can join up a meetup group that is designed around a specific interest. You know, it could be health foods, it could be hiking, it could be ghost hunting, it could be anything. And they get together face-to-face, nose-to-nose, in groups, in these meetups. And it's been pretty successful. This thing has really gone beyond what I ever thought it would. And I think the reason why is because I think that, you know, the online community, regardless of how big and how many numbers there are, there's an element missing there. And that is you never have any face-to-face confrontations or face-to-face encounters with other people. You know, so there isn't facial expressions. There isn't the tone of voice. The mannerisms and all these things. Just, you know, it's gone. It's absent.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO, and our guest is James Wades with the Morse Telegraph Club, WB8SIW. We'll be back right after this. A lot of radio amateurs get a big bang out of building antennas and experimenting, and I think we all do from time to time. But there comes a time when you're just dead serious about making contacts, and you want the antenna to be right. You want it to be a professionally designed, optimized piece of workhorse gear that's going to reach out there and do exactly what you want it to do. And the experimenting's over with. You're serious about operating. You're serious about contesting. You know, you're serious about working satellites or doing moon bounce, or maybe you're going on a de-expedition and you want to put up an array. I'm not talking about a portable antenna. I'm talking about an array. You want to put something on a tower that's big, that works. If you're looking for that kind of an antenna system, there's one place to look, and that's M Squared Antennas. M Squared. Their website is simply M2Inc.com. That's M2, and then Inc.com. M2Inc.com. M Squared Antennas. What you're going to find is HF monobanders. You're going to find HF log periodics. You're going to find HF multibanders, 6-meter antennas, 2-meter antennas, 220 megahertz antennas, 440, 902 to S-band. You're going to find their horizontal Omni, the thing that, boy, I'll tell you what, you're working moon bounce. You want to work moon bounce and you want to work satellites. They've got it knocked. They've got all the EME products you could possibly imagine. They have preamps. They have rotators. They have rotator controls. They've got phasing cables. I mean, they've got it all figured out, including preamps and solid-state amplifiers. Now, if that's what you're into, that's it. I'm telling you, one place to go, M Squared Antennas. Once again, their website is m2inc.com. That's M followed by the numeral 2 inc.com. Or you can go to our website, qsoradioshow.com. Go to their website, take a look around, and you know what? You can pick up the phone and you can call them and ask them questions about what it is you're trying to do, and they'll tell you what you need and they'll work with you. M Squared Antennas. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply qsoradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the QSO Radio Show, and notice I said radio. We come to you over the air. That's right. We are a radio show, but we also have this program available in podcast form should you miss a certain portion of it. And you can find that at QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, TedRandall, TedRandall.com. And we just want to let you know that. But first and foremost, we come over HF Radio to you, because that's what we like the best, and that's the way it really ought to be. We ought to come to you by means of HF Radio, and that's what we do. So thank you for tuning in, and now let's get back to our guest, James Wades, with the Morse Telegraph Club, WB8SIW. And I think that leaves a lot of folks cold. I think you really miss an awful lot. So I'm a promoter in this group called Meetup. I think that's a good thing. Those people get together once a month or every other week or something, and they all get together and do something where they all have a common interest, and they meet each other and talk to each other and all that kind of thing. And I think the online community, what it's done, because, yeah, there's a lot of crazy people in this world, but I think we've also developed some unfounded fears of meeting people. You know, we just don't know. He could be an axe murderer, you know. You know, you don't. We've really become a paranoid society because of that, I think. And I think that we miss all the friendly, good folks that are out there that really we would be far better off if they were connected to us and be a part of our lives. And we miss it because we're on Twitter and we're on Facebook and we're doing all this other stuff, you know. And we just don't. Anyway, that's my soapbox. I was going to back up just a bit here before we close out, because I don't want to keep you for an extended period of time and totally wreck your day. Because we're getting into the holiday season here. I'm sure you've got stuff to do. What I was going to ask you about, on the ham radio side of CW, let's back up a bit, and let me ask you the question, where would you tell someone, some guy that's been you know, he tunes down and listens a little bit, and he doesn't know the code, wants to learn the code, wants to get involved in RF over the radio CW, what's the route that you would recommend to somebody like that? How would you send them? In what direction?
Well, I would say, you know, I'll be honest, I'd recommend two different organizations that I think are very useful. Of course, the best known one is FISTS, which is a group of people that are dedicated to promoting CW on the amateur radio bands. And, of course, they have certain frequencies which they tend to tend to monitor and utilize, and that's typically around 058. So, for example, 7058, you know, 14058, you know, et cetera. And that's a good organization. Another group that's been growing very rapidly, which I'm actually a member of and I enjoy very much, is called the Straight Key Century Club, or SKCC. They have an email list online. It's you know, available through Yahoo groups, and it's a really a fun group of operators. The emphasis is on using, you know, straight keys and manual Morse keys. But along with that, you'll find a lot of new operators who are looking for people to, you know, get started with and operate at slower speeds. And you'll find they congregate around 7114 in that area in the old 40-meter novice band. And, you know, you can get a nice QSO there at, you know, 5-10 words a minute. And a lot of good operators that are patient and, you know, will take their time with you. And, of course, the email list is fun in that you can ask questions and, you know, get good insight and guidance from people. And they also have these small, I guess you might call them low-key contests called sprints, usually once a month, where you can get on the air at your own pace and your own speed and work people. And it's a lot of fun to participate in those. So I really like that SKCC group, Straight Key Century Club. And, of course, there's FISTS, which is another fine group. And those are really two areas where you can get involved with other people that want to learn code, you know, want to develop their skills, want to learn more about it. And you can get on some of those frequencies that they frequent, like 7055, you know, 7114, 7115 range. And you can have a nice, comfortable, slower speed QSO. You don't have to fight with the speed demons down there on the low end of the band that are trying to work DX, you know, and that type of thing. So those are two fine groups, I think, to associate yourself with if you're getting started in CW and you want to develop your skills. I believe FISTS has a Code Buddy program where they assign mentors to work with people that want to learn code, and I think that could be very beneficial as well.
For somebody just starting out, I know W1AW transmits bulletins, and I think they transmit those things at low speed as well, if you want to tune in and listen to that. And I'm sure there's some other stuff. You know, there was a fellow in Michigan, I don't even met him, but his name was Ed Trombley. He was up in Saginaw. Do you remember this guy?
I do.
Mm-hmm. He faithfully put a code practice session out every, I don't know, I guess maybe it was every night, I'm not sure, but it was on 160 meters. And, I mean, he was there faithfully every night putting the code out. And, you know, I met Ed when I lived up in Michigan, and he was just a remarkable gentleman, incredible guy. But do you know of anything like that going on where there are people on air doing actually transmitting code practice at all? Is there anyone doing that?
I don't know offhand, besides, of course, W1AW, the ARRL headquarters station. I believe there may be. I do know that some local radio clubs over the years have done code practice and code training on VHF, you know, 2-meter FM, and on their repeaters and so forth. So I know there's some of that going on, certainly. I think in the era of you know, the computer with so many new software programs and things like that available to teach code, I think a lot of people learn code that way. But certainly there's nothing like, you know, once you develop a, you know, basic level of skill, just getting out there and trying to get on the air and use it. That's the best way to learn. But it's sort of like working out at the gym. It's better if you have a workout buddy, too. You know, you find a friend who wants to learn code, and then the two of you can work on it together and encourage each other.
That's absolutely absolutely the best situation. And I also think, too, hearing it on the air strengthens your ability. Because coming out of a computer, it's nice and clean. You know, it's very clean, no problems. You know, but when you tune it in, you got that signal that's coming in just a little bit higher and the one that's a little bit lower. And if you don't have very narrow filtering on your radio, then you kind of have to block the other two out mentally. But all that, I think that's all cool because that puts you in the realistic situation of being able to copy it. Because I sit there and it's kind of funny. you'd have three or four. If you had a pretty broad receiver, you could have four or five people all sending in one spot. You're hearing them in one spot. And you could actually, with your mind, separate each and every one. You know, and you would, the other ones wouldn't bother you. You'd be focused on the one tone, and you're the brain, the best CW filter in the entire world, you could actually separate four or five signals. I mean, it got to the point sometimes when you couldn't, but I mean, it was odd. I mean, I sat there one day and I was thinking to myself, this friend of mine came in the room and he says, well, which one are you listening to? And I realized there were three or four guys sending on, and you could hear them. They were different pitches, but the brain just separates them. Somehow you just learn to do that, and you don't even hear those other signals. You're focused on the one signal. I don't know. Have you experienced that? Has that been something you've noticed, or has that been just in my weirdness?
Oh no. I think that's pretty common. I feel like people that learned or got involved in, say, amateur radio, or even, you know, say commercial radio telegraph communications and the like, you know, years ago, before you had the very narrow filters. You know, you learn to deal with the interference and the adjacent channel, you know, QRM and so forth. I don't have narrow filters on my receiver. You know, if I hear two or three other stations, as long as they're not zero beat, you know, or capturing the AGC to the point where it distorts the signal I'm listening to, I just listen to it. I use my brain as my narrow filter, and it actually can offer you some real advantages. You know, particularly if you want to move into, say, CWDX contesting, where the band is really packed, you know, with a lot of stations. For example, field day, you know, the big field day emergency drill, and really more of a contest these days. But, you know, you get on there and the whole band is packed with CW signals. Well, probably during the contest is not the time to learn how to use your brain as a filter, you know. And I think a lot of new radio amateurs, they buy a nice high grade, you know, transceiver of some kind, and it's got 50 hertz filters and 100 hertz filters and the like, and then they become so dependent upon those filters, they sort of become a crutch, and they never develop the ability to discern or concentrate on a CW signal when there's QRM or interference. But in reality, if you want to be good at contesting, or say, for example, you want to be a regular on a CW traffic net, there are times you have to put up with significant interference. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't control it. And having that ability in your brain, if you will, to concentrate on a single CW signal in a noisy environment is advantageous. I suppose it's not unlike years ago when you had the busy telegraph relay offices with, you know, 25, 50, 75 operators all going at the same time, and, you know, people walking around, and, you know, conveyors, you know, and all this kind of stuff, moving messages to the, you know, to the clerks and that kind of thing. People learn how to concentrate on just their one telegraph sounder. It's sort of the same thing. I think it makes you a better operator if you can use your brain as a filter as opposed to using the crutch of, say, narrow passband filters all the time on your radio.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I remember being a novice, I'd be on talking to someone, and someone would break or call you or call you, and they would be off frequency by a long shot. but for some reason, even though you were focused on the one person you were communicating with, when your call sign started coming across and it was off frequency, you would immediately recognize it. I mean, it was just right there. I mean, it's like, out of all the stuff, you have four signals all transmitting different things. You're focused on one, and all of a sudden this other signal comes in and sends your call sign. Bam, you've got it. I mean, you hear it, you notice attention, and you're right. It's a very, very that's a unique experience. It really is. It's an exercise in concentration as to how and focus, I guess, you know. But yet, even though you're focused, you're still aware, you know. So it's kind of a that's kind of thing. Now, if a person's getting started, and let's go down this road, and then we got to close it out because I don't want to keep you. What would you recommend? Should a person start with a code practice oscillator and a straight key? Is it better to try to learn the code with a key, or in other words, for as your sending is concerned, with a paddle? And I never could get a bug to work for me. I never was able to work with one of those things. But and some guys, I mean, boy, they just go to town. Put a Vibroplex down on the table, and they're just, you know, they're 35, 40 words a minute and higher. So how would you recommend a person starting out? Because I think a lot of times folks get overwhelmed at this. They look at it, or they tune in CW, and they, oh, man, I'm not going to learn this. And one of the things I saw done was, and I used to do this with friends, I would sit down and I would send like five characters. And I would send those five characters over and over and over, and they'd actually learn them in a matter of just a few minutes. In other words, they could identify each one, and I'd say, okay, now, that's five characters. That's one group, okay? And if you think about it this way, there's five groups of five characters. So now all you got to do is learn four more groups, and you got all the letters. And they would be amazed at that. Really? You know, is that, it's that simple? Break it down like that, and they didn't know what to say. You know, so you just learned five characters right there. You're recognizing them by sound. You know, and the one thing I always say: do not convert these things to shorts and longs, dots, dashes. Forget that. Listen to the sound. When you hear da 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 da, you know that's a C. You don't even think about longs and shorts. It's a sound. And when they would learn like that, boy, they could knock the actual code out. And as soon as you got it committed inside your head that each sound you can recognize and write it down, you're already at five words a minute. I mean, that's the way it was then. But give us suggestions. A person is just starting in this. What would you tell them to do?
Well, yeah, there's really two issues. You know, one is how you learn to receive the code, and the other one, of course, is how you learn to send it. And my first advice to anybody, you know, in terms, let us deal with the sending first, you know, how you properly learn to send Morse. And I believe that every operator should learn with a standard key, that is the straight key. And the reason for that is it develops your sense of rhythm and your sense of timing. And that's of fundamental importance as your speed increases. So, you know, it's a little bit like learning the guitar or the piano. You know, you need to learn the basic technique first, and then you worry about the more advanced, you know, techniques. The same thing is true with sending the Morse code, and that is you want to start with a straight key. You want to learn how to properly time and space your characters and invest your time in that. And eventually it becomes automatic, and then speed naturally follows. What you see a lot of today are new operators. The first thing they do is they go out and buy an electronic keyer. And, you know, of course, it's an impressive-looking device, and it allows you to make the characters correctly because the dots and dashes are automatic. But they commit numerous sins on the air, like running the letters together, not providing sufficient space between words, and so on. So definitely start with a straight key. Use that on the air first and learn how to be good with a straight key. And then, once you're good with the straight key, you can move to an electronic key or a bug. And a bug is not particularly hard to learn, but it has to be set up correctly. The problem with the Viberplex key, that is the bug, is that the average operator has no idea how to initially set it up, and he learns to send incorrectly with it. So if you're going to use a bug properly, there's good documentation online. There's even a YouTube video and so forth that you can look for on how to properly adjust the Viberplex, and it'll tell you what kind of spacing to use between the left and right stop screw and the, you know, dash contact and the lever and that kind of thing. Set it up correctly first before you learn to use a bug. But generally speaking, I always start with a straight key. Learn how to be a good operator with a straight key. A good operator should be able to send 15, 18 words a minute with a straight key. Once you can do that with a straight key, then you can move on to the electronic key or the bug and learn those devices. By then, your sense of rhythm and, you know, your sense of spacing and how to properly form Morse will be well-developed, and the other instruments will come easily and correctly for the sake of your brother radio amateurs or brother and sister radio amateurs. As far as learning to receive the code, I think you hit on the cardinal sins. And that is never count dots and dashes. Never write dots and dashes down and then try and translate them. You need to learn the rhythm of the character. And rhythm is really the discerning factor. Learn how to recognize each character's unique rhythm. That's why, for example, in the military, they start out with things like E, I, S, H, and 5. And they send the characters quickly. So you learn to discern did it, and so on. This allows a person to recognize characters based on sound, based on those kinds of, you know, the rhythm patterns. character. And so that's, you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, don't, you know, your goal is to develop a vocabulary, you know, just like when you hear words in the English language or in a foreign language with which you're proficient, you think in that language, and that's absolutely critical to learning the code well.
I guess I never was able to understand folks that hear it in terms of, like, sentences. In other words, they're copying an entire sentence in their head. Oh, man.
Well, the better operator will eventually learn how to copy whole words and so forth. I mean, as the you know, your one's abilities evolve, that's sort of what happens. You know, you begin to recognize whole patterns like and particularly, you know, words that kind of are, you know, that connect language together. And so there is a difference between copying, for example, unrelated letters. And you'll find most operators, for example, can copy plain text faster than they can copy cipher groups. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, in the commercial radio telegraph exams, if you want to qualify for, say, a second or first class radio telegraph license, they might send you, you have to qualify for the cipher groups at, you know, say 20 words a minute and the plain text at 25, because they recognize that, you know, the proficient operator copies unrelated letters a bit slower than he does plain text.
Well, listen, I don't, we're out of time. So I want to go right back to square one and talk about the Morse Telegraph Club. I want you to tell folks how to get in touch. What does membership involve, and where they can find you on the web and so on and so forth.
Okay, yeah, the Morse Telegraph Club has a webpage, which is very easy to remember. It's simply www.morsetelegraphclub.org. And you can go there and learn about the Morse Telegraph Club and our activities. If you want to learn a little bit more about our related Morse KOB system, that's our sort of nationwide landline Morse network that operates over the Internet, that's at www.morsekob.org. That's Kilo Oscar Bravo, Morse KOB, all one word, .org. And the Morse Telegraph Club, of course, publishes a quarterly journal entitled Dots and Dashes. Dots and Dashes has different articles on, you know, telegraph history and first-person accounts, club activities, chapter activities, and so forth. It's a very nicely produced quarterly journal. And so if you have an interest in telegraph history, railroad history, any of these kinds of subjects, I think you'll find Dots and Dashes to be very worthwhile. And, of course, we have chapters throughout the United States and Canada that one can join. So you can either be a member at large, or if you live in an area where there's a Morse Telegraph Club chapter, you can join through the chapter. Dues are $15 a year, slightly higher in Canada because of the cost of delivering Dots and Dashes, but generally $15 per year. You can find a membership application on our webpage at www.morsetelegraphclub.org. And there's all kinds of activities you can get involved in. We do telegraph demonstrations at historical events. Some of our members are engaged in providing telegraph services as part of Civil War reenactments. We've put together temporary museum exhibits for large public museums, you know, build museum exhibits for railroad museums and the like. Talks, many of our members put on talks for local amateur radio clubs and you know, historical associations and the like. And so there's just a whole bunch of different things you can do through your Morse Telegraph Club membership. We've even, for example, those of you that have seen the recent release of Spielberg's Lincoln, I was technical advisor for Lincoln, and was involved in putting together the War Department and City Point sets and the like. And I had a great help from all of our Morse Telegraph Club members who provided, you know, historically appropriate instruments and so forth for the telegraph scenes that occur in Spielberg's Lincoln. So we've done several movies where we provided instruments and advice and information for movie producers, documentary producers, and so on. So it's very much both a living history organization as well as, a fraternal association.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I encourage folks to get involved with the Morris Telegraph Club and to, this is a very, very unusual, unique experience and can provide a lifetime of enjoyment and learning and accomplishment. But I thank you so much for joining us, and I want you to come back again sometime soon, and we'll talk some more.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's about all the time we've got for QSO this week. Once again, don't forget, QSO is a real radio show coming to you over HF. Also available on podcast, of course, and you can find us up on iTunes and on Zune and a few other places along with our website. We invite you to visit the website, and that's just simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com or TedRandall.com. Thank you for listening. Join us again next week, same time, same station, for another QSO.